Chapter 7. The Conclave of Traitors. Risks and Benefits. For the Glory of the Gods. The Vengeful Spirit, Lunar Orbit, 24th of Secundus.
You are displeased, First Captain.
Abaddon scowled blackly at Laak. They walked dark corridors towards Lupercal's court.
I told you to keep out of my head.
Laak chuckled wetly.
I am not in your mind, cousin. I do not need to be. You do nothing to hide your emotions. Your expression says everything your voice will not. You are unhappy. I say you would fare badly in a game of wages.
This isn't a game, Laak, growled Abaddon.
Is it not? You think like a gamesman, formulating moves and counter-moves.
This is war, said Abaddon irritably.
I'm not talking about the war out there. I'm talking about the struggle in here.
He tapped his free hand to his primary heart. Abaddon turned on his heel, fist clenched, bringing the small group of captain, blade slaves, and apostle to an abrupt halt at a junction in the corridor. Again the blade slaves objected to his attitude to their lord, and cracks in the armour flared, and their hands went to the hilts of their swords.
Go on, said Abaddon. Try.
The blade slaves remained ready to fight. Warp light shone from their helm lenses. Ash drifted around them like snow. Chuckling, Laak raised his hand, fingers upright. He let the gesture hang in clear threat, then shook his ornate staff. The blade slaves removed their hands from their swords.
I told you, said Abaddon. Stay out of my head.
Having a little trouble with your priest, Ezekiel.
Horus Aximand approached the group from the transverse way, joining them at the junction.
Lord Horus himself is my patron, Horus Aximand, said Laak. It is your brother here who is having trouble with his faith.
Aximand's ruined face sat badly on his skull, stretching his once handsome features into an angry leer. They still called him Little Horus, though he barely resembled their gene-sire any longer. The hilt of his famed sword, Mourn It All, protruded above the top of his power plant.
I grant they're annoying, said Aximand, but we have these word-bearers to thank for the return of our father to health.
Do we?
Said Abaddon. He resumed walking.
Where are the others?
Kyber hangs around the Warmaster like a bad smell, as is his habit. He will not leave Horus's side without being dismissed. His brain has gone soft since Beta Garmon and Horus's return.
Abaddon did not disagree. Horus's fall had shaken Kyber to a pathetic degree.
Tormageddon?
He does as he pleases.
Aximand's expression became more horrible as he frowned.
But he will be at the court for this. Then you are blessed, said Laak. The Neverborn show you favour. I'd rather he showed his favour somewhere I wasn't, said Aximand. You should embrace it, said Laak. You are champions of the Pantheon. The might of the warp can be yours if you but reach out to take it.
Aximand snorted through his misshapen nose.
I'll pass. The blessings of your gods have been decidedly mixed of late. Gilliman breathes down our neck. The Warmaster makes no move on the prize. Is a blessed warlord forced to keep his generals apart for the harm they will do each other? This edification is to be conducted by Hololith. Gathering his brothers in one place has become too much of a risk for the Warmaster,
Aximand continued.
Angron, who by your estimation is probably very blessed indeed, rages at everything when he has control of himself, which is never, and when he does not, he has the unfortunate habit of butchering everyone around him.
He continued, the voice of reason emanating from his devil mask of a face.
Then there's Lord Fulgrim, who especially annoys Lord Angron. True to his nature, Fulgrim revels in Angron's ire and goads the Red Angel for his own amusement, which puts us all in danger. That's not to mention the fumes around the Phoenician that choke the mortals who breathe them.
Aximand shook his head ruefully.
Perturabo sulks on the fringes of the system. Mortarion approaches but refuses to answer any hails. Horus's grand army is riven by divisions at every level.
Indiscipline is our enemy now as much as time, said Abaddon. This is what your gods bring us, Leoc. Chaos, he said sourly.
Things were going so well, said Axamand, until you failed to catch the Fenrisian Ezekiel. The wolf, the consul, and the raven at our backs. Time grows short.
So good, then, that you and Kyber kept everything working smoothly while I was about my supposed failure, said Abaddon sharply. Horus cannot arbitrate every disagreement. The war will be won soon enough.
What if it isn't? Countered Axamand. Horus could allow you or I to do something about these divisions, but he won't. Worse, he forbids any activity on our part. Something has changed. Horus has not been the same since Malachurst brought him back.
Says the man who fought to prevent it, yet who wept tears of blood when our father returned from the dead a second time. Hypocrisy does not become you, brother.
Axamand looked at his brother sternly.
Mock me all you like, Ezekiel. I know you agree with me.
Abaddon grunted.
He did not disagree, but he would not add to his father's burdens by feeding Axamand's fears.
Lupercal's court was dark and forbidding. It was hard to remember how it was before Davin, a place of glory, where honourable men met to decide the fate of a galaxy. Abaddon assumed it had been so, rather than truly recalled it. The vengeful spirit stank of the warp's influence, and it cheated men's minds. On the surface, not much had altered. The banners had changed, along with their allegiance, but the same decisions were made there. The same tables and chairs furnished the room, and many of the same warriors attended. The real transformation was less obvious. It lingered out of sight, an unmistakable taint that hung over the hall, and a coy scent that refused definition, forever on the edge of sensing. Hints of incense, burnt sugar, and powdered bone. The source of the unease was centred on Horus. Abaddon stared at his father. Again he was disturbed by what he saw. The War Master sat rigid on his throne, looking off into hidden worlds, not blinking, smiling knowingly, dull eyes oblivious to all that went on around him. The cracked skull of Ferus Manus sitting on the throne's armrest had more presence than the War Master at the moment, staring with empty-eyed defiance over the gathering. Kyber stood at Horus's left side at stiff attention. He and Abaddon had hardly exchanged words in the last few weeks. Tormageddon, the demon, wearing its third stolen body, attended at Horus's right. It wore a smirk that echoed Horus's distant smile. Elements of Grail Noctua remained in Tormageddon's warped features, but it was a dangerous illusion. Tormageddon's being was wholly alien. It was at best a temporary ally. Tormageddon was another threat, another warp foulness that poisoned Abaddon's father, twisting him away from what he had been, making him in the god's image and robbing him of his will.
Ezekiel, little Horus, Tormageddon greeted them.
Kyber was slow to acknowledge their presence, looking between the members of the party before speaking.
Brothers, he said eventually, the Mournival is gathered.
Axamand looked suspiciously at Tormageddon. Both he and Abaddon had a hard time accepting the demon as one of their own, but as Horus decreed it, so it must be.
For the final moves in this long war, said Abaddon.
He clasped arms with Kyber, then did the same with the demon, doing his best to mask his distaste. Axamand greeted Kyber, but pointedly ignored the Neverborn. A change came over the War Master as he returned from that other place his spirit so often went. His smile smoothed away. He grew in stature. Unease was replaced by calm. As Horus looked over them all and blessed them with his attention, Abaddon caught a glimpse of the man he had known.
My sons, said Horus, the hour approaches.
Horus rose from his throne. His presence was such that the Mournival struggled to remain standing, while Leoc freely knelt. Horus had always possessed a preternatural charisma, but this was something else. A dark majesty that demanded all the universe grovel before it.
My brothers, Horus commanded, hearken to me.
One by one, cones of hololithic projection light leapt into being around the court, turning the shadows grey and filling the space with phantoms. Besides Horus, only the Morneval and Laax group were present in the flesh. First to emerge was Angron. The transformation wrought on him made Horus's change inconsequential. He was a red-skinned giant, the equal in size of the Pantheon's greatest servants. Huge wings of tattered black skin furled around his back. The cables of the butcher's nails, the archaeotech device implanted in his brain when he was a slave, hung from his scalp around jutting horns in a tangle of metallic dreadlocks. Wild yellow eyes stared from a face contorted forever with hate and rage, and his jaw worked around wolf's teeth. He paced with poorly contained rage, making the role of the imagists on his ship difficult. He swam in and out of focus, and often only his face remained visible. He gave voice only to growls. Fulgrim was next. A purple-skinned serpentine monster, with four arms and a shock of ghost-white hair. Though he remained within the viewing field, Fulgrim was never still. Overwhelmed by his unnatural form as much as by his fidgeting, occasionally the hololith would fail completely and present a jumble of white hair, serpent's body and mocking faces, interspersed with glimpses of other places alive with abstract horrors.
"Hello, brother,"
he said, always on the verge of mockery. Perturabo's image snapped into being. The Lord of Iron remained in the outer system, more distant than the rest, and consequently his image lacked the definition of the others. He flickered, but persisted like a bad memory, unwelcomely recalled. Unlike his brothers, he retained his original form, too stubborn to give himself over to worship as they had.
"I attend you, my war master," he said solemnly.
Following Perturabo, Magnus the Red appeared, manifesting as a psychic projection that lent him a form of ersatz reality superior to the hololithic phantoms. When he walked, the air moved. Abaddon could smell his foreign scent. Despite the veracity of his image, it was a sorcerous falsehood that prickled at the skin and the soul. The Cyclops wore the appearance of a crimson-skinned ogre clad in rich jewellery. Clothing himself in majesty, he attempted to hide his true altered form. He could not quite. The projection stuttered, showing some of the many faces Magnus favoured. Magnus had ever appeared in different guise, but masking what he had become seemed to tax him. And though he affected a studious air, all the expressions on all of his faces hinted at his pain.
"Brothers," Magnus said, "Ezekiel, Little Horus, Falcus, and to you, Tormageddon, and to the priest, I give greetings."
With the principal players in place, dozens of lesser images flickered into being. Some full bodies, others disembodied heads. The highest officers, the grandest marshals and most lordly of admirals, commanders of the mortal armies that gave Horus's forces so much of their size and might, and which outnumbered the manpower of the legions hundreds of times over. The Fabricator General's image appeared late among this crop, so large it swallowed several of the smaller phantoms. Kelbor Howl was finally free of Mars, and took the place of his emissary Sota Nul, who had been at Horus's side these last years. Abaddon thought it a change for the worse. Sota Nul had been most useful, whereas the Fabricator General was inflated with a sense of self-importance. Abaddon doubted Kelbor Howl knew how much his overweening pride offended the War Master. Barely had the group gathered when Angron launched into a familiar tirade.
"When do we attack?"
He thrust his head close to the imaging equipment, reducing his communications phantom to a single glaring eye.
"Why do we sit here in the void when our weapons cannot harm our father?
We must land. Take the fight to him with blade and fist. The god of battle demands blood.
Fulgrim let out a musical laugh.
You may not believe this, Brother Horus, but I am in agreement with our angry sibling. This bombardment is boring. Let my perfect sons run free. They will give you a swift victory. Your peacocks will achieve nothing,
shouted Angron, so loudly the auto-feed of his hololith shrieked with feedback.
My legion shall be first, mine! We are the chosen of war! Give me the order, brother, and end this carnage!
Do you call the war master coward?
Said Fulgrim slyly.
I say he bides his time for the Lord of Death to join us. Has Mortarion not yet arrived?
He feigned disappointment at the 14th Legion's absence.
There is no word yet from his fleet, my lord, Kyber reported. They approach and will be here within days.
He was to be first on Terra. He begged you for the honor,
scoffed Angron.
And he will not even speak. Give me the task, and I shall show you how ruin is made.
Horus stared at Angron with a baleful eye. He allowed his brother to rant on.
We smashed aside Dawn's feeble defences,
Angron said.
We broke Lunar in days. Why now do we slink around the throne world like curs, waiting for Mortarion when victory is in our grasp?
We smashed Dawn's defences.
Perturabo's leaden response simmered with anger.
I broke Dawn's gates, not we. Your sons did not plead to ensure our success. You gave no plan to penetrate the system defences. I delivered the solar system to the War Master.
You claim a role in a victory you were not party to. Do you forget that I had to drag you back from your orgy of bloodletting to rejoin our brother?
Were it not for me, you would not be here. Fulgrim would not be here. None of you would be here now.
You have done your part, little digger,
Angron scoffed.
Land the legions now. Let me be the point of the spear aimed at father's heart. Cease this game. Bombardment is a weakling's ploy.
Perturabo stiffened, taking the comment personally, which was surely Angron's intention.
Attempt to land and see how quickly father's guns tear you to pieces, said Perturabo.
Silence, said Horus. His voice was hardly louder than a whisper, but it brought immediate quiet.
You will be silent now, all of you.
All proceeds to plan. Perturabo, explain, said Horus. Angron snorted when Perturabo began. Horus cowed him with a glance.
Three things stand in our way, Perturabo began. The palace guns, the palace aegis, and father's will, which keeps the Neverborn at bay. These problems cannot be resolved at once, but must be dealt with in order, beginning with the aegis. The bombardment patterns I have devised have revealed multiple shortcomings in the palace's shields. Between the hours I spend each day fortifying the outer reaches against our brother's coming, tasks not one of you have taken upon yourselves, he grumbled, I have been examining Auspex soundings of the void shield network.
The priests of Mars designed the aegis, applying knowledge salvaged from the high days of technology,
said Kalbor Hal proudly.
You will find no weakness there.
Then why do you not provide us with the information necessary to shut it down? Said Abaddon.
Impossible, said Kalbor Hal. The control systems for the shields are as impregnable as the Aegis itself.
He was proud, a vain fool.
Every wall has a weakness. Build it how you will, from whatever material you can. Stone, iron, or dancing light, I shall bring it down, said Perturabo.
The centre is too strong as yet to break. Ground operations will be necessary to collapse the network to the extent that direct landing or bombardment will be successful within the palace bounds.
Then let us be about it!
Angron howled. Perturabo gave the Chosen of Khorne a sullen stare.
Against the success of such an action, the Lord of Iron continued, stand the following factors. Firstly, the shields possess a wide-range modulation, beginning at the lower reach against any penetration of objects above 1.5 gram, travelling faster than 2 meters per second. Infantry might walk through this aegis,
but slowly.
Impossible, said Aximand. Voids are no defense against close attacks.
These are not void shields, as you understand them, said Perturabo. The second factor against ground assault is the palace's extensive anti-air and anti-orbital defenses, and its air defense squadrons. Before a major landing can be undertaken, these must be weakened, or any force sent against them will be annihilated in the air.
You spoke of weaknesses, said Fulgrim. Then pray tell, O glowering sulky brother, where are they?
The shields cannot be brought down from outside, said Perturabo, continuing his lecture as if Fulgrim had not spoken. The palace possesses an unrivaled void network consisting of multiple layers of lenticular fields. These differ from a standard voidal energy bubble, which forms a single skin defense around its ward in spherical or hemispherical configuration. The technology required to project stable lensing is exceedingly difficult to replicate, and at this scale, practically impossible. Yet following the old patterns, the Mechanicum succeeded. The palace Aegis networks consist of discrete elements, like a wall of shields, each an energy lens, each one overlapping the others enough that failure on the part of one reveals only a small hole directly blocked below. By the time the lower lenses covering the hole are also brought down, the first will have been raised again. There are legions of Mechanican adepts laboring beneath the palace to keep the shields in operation. Multiple redundancy networks protect against failures up to full systemic levels. Power is provided by advanced thermal conversion beneath the palace itself. It is a low-yield but stable energy source, and cannot be upset by magnetic frequency harmonics as a plasma reactor might be. The power supply cannot be directly targeted. Only the destruction of the planet itself would be sufficient to interrupt the flow of energy from the palace vaults to the Aegis.
Then let us sit down and lead our warriors in glorious charge against the walls, growled Angron.
That would result in your total destruction, either on descent or on the ground.
Cowards!
Be patient, brother, said Perturabo. You will have your glory. The shields cannot be broken. They cannot be starved of power. But they can be weakened. An orbital vid capture of a section of the palace defences sprang up. The walls, cut across the landscape, neat as a draftsman's marks. The palace city's giant buildings were models behind. The flattened coins of explosions, displaced by void shielding, blinked all over the defences, not touching the ground beneath. This sequence depicts a rare failure. Within the bombardment pattern, I concealed several distinct targeting cycles to test various aspects of the Aegis. Modulation, raising speed, power absorption and displacement, displacement response time, displacement triggering velocity, and others.
I provided all this information, protested Kelbor Howe.
Consolidated datasets fall into false, idealistic patterns. Direct, practical experimentation is the only way I can be sure. The result of my test can be witnessed here, said Perturabo. Several shells and a volley of lance fire sparked off the shields. Suddenly a gap opened over a tower, exposing it to fire from orbit that quickly toppled it. Alas, this small result was achieved only due to an isolated flaw in that part of the network. Augury readings suggest a chained failure in three series of void generatoria. Quickly rectified.
Not so perfect, eh, Kalbor Hal? Giggled Fulgrim.
Note how quickly the shield is replaced, Perturabo continued. Over the burning rubble, the explosions changed back to toothless rounds of fire flattened on the shields.
Then what are you proposing?
Growled Angron. His head shook, his face twitched, but he held his temper. His display of control was impressive. From this response time, and the other measurements provided to me from the main fleet, I have determined that the voids can be weakened sufficiently to allow passage of medium to low velocity objects, around the fringe only. Our brother has calculated a bombardment pattern of surpassing genius, said Horus. For a moment, Perturabo's stolid expression showed a glint of pride. We will unleash all of our fleet's firepower at these points. The vid feed disappeared, replaced by a wider angle, tri-D view of the entire palace. Equally spaced red markers blinked on all eight principal winds of the compass. and the precision of Perturabo's attack will cause a serial weakening of the shield wall.
Then it can be bombed,
said Fulgrim. The bombardment will not penetrate the final layer, said Perturabo. Rapid high-mass munitions or zero-to-low-mass light-speed energy emissions will still be displaced. However, the final Aegis layer will be weakened sufficiently to allow a 70% chance of successful passage to attack craft travelling at 150 kilometres an hour or lower.
We can attack directly. What fine news!
Fulgrim clapped with glee.
I shall prepare my squadrons at once.
Perturabo nodded. Attack ships should prioritise void shield projection blisters and anti-ship weaponry towers, with secondary emphasis on anti-aircraft emplacements. Voids have one true vulnerability, that their projecting elements must be exposed. A large number are mounted on the wall itself. I predict an attrition rate of 45% attack ships lost, minimum. However, though the defences are formidable, we shall darken the sky with such numbers they will despair, said Perturabo.
While the palace defences are occupied by our aerial attack, said Horus, we will begin first landings. By splitting the enemy's fire, we safeguard both attack and landing craft. Dawn will not want his guns destroyed, nor will he want our warriors outside the walls. But they cannot afford to lose their shields.
I will prepare my warriors,
bellowed Angron.
That brings us to the problem of the Neverborn, Perturabo said. He paused. Who will tell him?
You must find patience, my brother,
Magnus said to Angron.
The warp is in turmoil around Terra, but no demon may set foot there. Our father's power holds back the tides of the Empyrean. If you, I, or Fulgrim were to attempt a landing, our souls would be torn from our bodies and likely obliterated.
Perturabo's genius shows us the first cracks in Dawn's walls. We must force another, said Horus. Every drop of blood spilled upon Terra's soil weakens our father's power. The second blow will quickly follow the first. Once our allies of the warp have access to the mortal sphere and the orbital defences of Terra are crippled, then the legions shall attack.
There is a way to limit our father's power.
Magnus waved his hand, and a new image, far sharper than any hololith, appeared. Lines joined the 8 points together into an octet superimposed over the palace.
Center this upon the palace. Spill enough blood. Then, and only then, Lord Angron, will father's might be contained, and you may set foot safely upon Terra. Shortly after, all the legions of Neverborn, contained by eternity, shall march forth.
Sow the dragon's teeth, water the harvest with the blood of untold millions, and we shall come to you,
said Laak, quoting from obscure scriptures.
We do not need the help of these unclean things, my lord, said Axamand.
Tormageddon snickered.
This is not your war alone, little Horus. Greater beings than you have a stake here.
He gestured to Fulgrim and Angron knowingly.
It shall be as I decree, commanded Horus. There is no need for the legions to march yet. The Emperor will conserve his best troops behind his walls. We shall land our mortal followers all over the throne world. Every city shall be attacked, every settlement burned. Let the lost and the damned tire his guns. Let the false emperor know despair behind his mighty walls while his people suffer.
And when the tide of blood is high enough and our demonic allies are ready to infest Terra, the outer defences shall be broken, the guns cast down, and the defenders left bloody and bruised. Then we shall unleash the true face of death. Lord Fulgrim, Lord Angron, prepare your legions for ground operations. When the time is right, they shall follow in the wake of Lord Mortarion. This I promise you.